Sometimes we need to slow down and remember the simple pleasures in life. Good coffee, good books, and good company. Come on in. Take a seat. The coffee's just been brewed. Let's see who we have in the coffee shop today.
Book. Book. I'm looking for the book on the table. Where's the book? There's a book. There's a book. And the title of it is called Birds of Wonder. How amusing. And the name on the book is Cynthia Robinson. How you doing today, Cynthia?
I'm doing very well. Thank you for inviting me.
Oh, love to have guests in the coffee shop. So you've got to tell me a little bit about this book. It's such an interesting title.
Yes. Okay. It starts off, the reader will probably begin thinking that she is reading a police procedural because it starts off with the discovery of the body of a young girl, a high school age girl, 17, who has appeared in a field and has been found by an English teacher walking her dog. And because the town is a small town, smallish town, the teacher knows the student. This is one of her students. She picks up her phone or picks her phone out of her pocket. She dials the police. The police just happens to be her daughter, who is a detective and who is also a little bit of a woman about town in that she kind of likes to have fleeting liaisons with numerous men, one of them being the owner of the field in which the girl has been discovered. And so off we go.
Oh, that sounds absolutely fascinating. And I'm now getting the feedback again.
Uh-oh. Let me lower it a little bit more?
Would you?
Yeah, how about now?
We'll keep going.
Okay.
But that sounds absolutely fascinating. I mean, you start with this dead body. I mean, they always say you've got to start with something attention-getting. Well, I guess a dead body would definitely get your attention.
Yes, and I take it sort of goes along for a couple of chapters. People might think they're in a sort of normal police procedural. And then very quickly, you realize that it's becoming a character-driven novel. The story is told in six different voices, six different people speak. Jess, who is the detective, her mother, Beatrice, who finds the body. Edward, who is this very strange, a little bit has-been artist who is back in town. This is an upstate New York town where a lot of people spend summers. Some of us live here year-round, but there's also lots of lakes, and it's really beautiful in the summer, and a lot of sort of city people come up from Manhattan or from Philly and spend the summer. So he's probably going to be your number one suspect. That would probably be the one most readers would be thinking, this guy is a perv. He could have done it. He probably did. We also hear from Liam Walsh, who is the guy in whose field Amber has been found. He's a child services lawyer. Amber was a foster child, and so he's had dealings with her in the past. He does know her, and so he's a suspect. And he's also the guy with whom Jess, the detective, had a one-night stand a couple of months before, which makes things a bit awkward between them. And we also hear from Amber's foster brother, Connor, who is he's gay, he's a photographer, he's very creative. He's also very entrepreneurial, as happens with kids sometimes who've been in the foster system for a number of years. It's like they realize they have to scrap for what they're going to get. They have to scrap. And he's a very scrappy guy. And then we hear from this guy named Waldo, who is one of Liam's workers on the vineyard. And he's a bit, you're probably not going to be completely sure whether he's schizophrenic, what exactly it is that's going on inside his mind that makes him not completely normal. And it was a very interesting voice for me to write. And he was actually patterned after a man who works at a vineyard owned by a friend of a friend of mine around here near Ithaca. I've never met the man, but I've heard a lot about him, and he just struck me as such an interesting character. He has a really special way with plants. He's almost like a plant whisperer. And so Waldo is the sixth character, and I tell the story alternating each of the voices. I go through the voices, I think, five times. And through those separate voices, the story begins to coalesce.
Sounds like you really brought in a number of outside voices here. Did you find one of them harder to write than the others?
Yes. I found Jess, the detective. She's 31. She is certainly, I'm far from 31 now. That was a long time ago. It's way back in the rearview mirror. But for a number of reasons, she felt the closest to me. And I think characters, I think this might surprise a lot of readers who aren't also writers, that the idea of the character that's the closest to you and at first glance would probably seem like the easiest to write. But it's not, because you have to separate yourself far enough from them in order to make them come alive. And it's also a character who is close to you is also a character that you might want to protect and not let bad things happen to. And that's something a writer can't do. And it really was when I decided to go ahead and let things happen to Jess that the plot was asking for, that I was kind of circling around and not really wanting to put in there. When I finally just said, okay, this is where the plot wants to go, I'm going to do it. That's when I really felt her come alive. That's when the novel finally landed its publisher. So that was a lesson to me about dealing with characters that are very close to you.
That sounds like a very interesting lesson.
I mean, memoir is one thing. Like if you're going to write a memoir, nothing is ever going to be completely unfiltered between what happened to you and what winds up on the page, right? There's always going to be some filter of memory. You're going to leave certain details out. You're going to put others in. But if you're writing a memoir, that's a more straightforward task vis-a-vis yourself. And fiction writers, I think often, I could tell you, if we had hours and hours, I could tell you there are parts of me, my history, myself, in each one of those six characters. But Jess was certainly the one that was the closest to me. And she was the hardest to make come alive on the page.
So in some ways, has Jess become your alter ego?
It's so funny with readers who know the book well, who know Jess, when I have to do a sort of put your bitch boots on kind of moment and kick some, you know what, into shape, I will say I'm channeling Jess. If there's something going on that needs fixing, she's going to fix it, and she's not having it. And so oftentimes I'll find myself sort of, channeling her when I need to get something done to whip some people into shape.
Wow. Now, writing isn't your day job.
No, it's not. I began to write before I even knew what it was. When I was very, very small, I made up stories. I made up stories through picture books. I had a librarian aunt. I grew up in Tennessee, and I had a librarian aunt who gave me my first book, was Peter Rabbit. And instead of sleeping with the typical teddy bear like little kids do, I slept with the book, Peter Rabbit, and I chewed on it and drooled on it. And I think she probably had to replace it several times, but I always had Peter Rabbit. And I was always making up stories. I was always, in one way or another, involved in doing that. But my career path did not take me that way. It's funny because in freshman year in college, actually, one of my English professors asked me to stay after class. And I thought, oh my God, here comes my first, first F of my college career. And what he actually had to say was that he said, you have to be a writer. And so I immediately became an art historian because I don't listen to advice. And it was many, many, many years later that the opportunities seemed to kind of line up, that kind of the stars, it sounds really hokey to say, but the stars in some way seemed to line up and say, okay, you just turned 50. You're either going to try this now or you're going to regret that you didn't. And so I thought, okay, let's try this. But my day job is actually, I'm chair of the art history department at Cornell University, and my specialization is medieval art and culture, as well as Islamic art and culture. That's what I teach.
That must be a fascinating topic with all the things going on in the Middle East these days.
It is. And I've noticed more of an urgency among the students who take those classes. They want to know, because they see the applicability of, just yesterday, for instance, I was giving a lecture to my students of the very earliest days of Islam. and Islam's setting itself up as an empire, the Umayyad Empire in the 8th and 9th century, 7th and 8th centuries, excuse me. And the first monuments, really monumental culture that came into being in Jerusalem. We were talking about the Dome of the Rock. And you can imagine all of the applications of that to the current situation. And it was a really, I almost didn't want to end class. And I could barely get through my lecture because my lecture style is very open. I always tell them, if you have a question to ask, oftentimes others in the class can benefit from your question. So raise your hand, I'll stop talking, and we'll hear your question. And so it was a very, very interesting day.
It sounds like it would have been a fascinating time to be in your class.
And I also get a lot of, I get a lot of students who are maybe first generation, they're Muslim, but they were born in the States and maybe their first language is English. And yet they're through their parents, they have ties to where they're from. And so it's really interesting to them to think, okay, the 7th century, the 8th century, the 12th century, wow, you know, not necessarily something that their parents, who are their links back to their culture at home, maybe not necessarily something their parents would be all that well versed in. I feel this is a good time for me to be doing what I'm doing.
That's fantastic.
You asked me another question, or do you want me to keep going?
Oh, I was just about to ask one.
Yeah, ask me.
How did you come up with the names for your characters? And did you plot out the novel? Did you know where it was going when you sat down to write the opening scene? Or did you just kind of let the characters run away with it?
Good questions. Very good questions. Names for the characters. I usually start out before I plot it out. And I do have a very strict way of plotting. And I'll tell you what that is in just a minute. But before I sit down to actually write the story, I'll do a lot of just writing about the characters, like what do they do? What are their jobs? What do they have for breakfast? Actually, something I learned in a fiction workshop, this wonderful workshop at Squaw Valley in California, which if anyone is interested in writing, anyone wants to get a chance to work with top flight writers critiquing your work, it is such a worthy thing to do to go to Squaw Valley community of writers workshops. Highly, highly recommended. And the first year I was there, I was in a workshop early in the morning. I am not a morning person. So me getting my butt out of bed to be at a workshop at 7:30 in the morning, that is a sacrifice. And it was with this guy who he was a movie producer. Unfortunately, he died a couple of years ago, Gil Dennis. And his workshop is called Finding the Story. And for each of your characters, the idea is to get you, for each of your characters, to imagine the most terrifying moment of their life, the most joyful moment of their life, and the most shameful moment of their life, and what they would have done in response to those situations. And you start out by telling those things about yourself. And it's very interesting because you're in a group of about 12 people. You're speaking, and the other people in your group are recording what you say. Or transcribing. And at the end of the workshop, your three stories are read back to you. And it's amazing how those three increments that you are plucking from completely disparate moments of your life, especially if your life has been, if you're in your fifth decade or sixth, I guess, like I am, it's a long life to pluck things from. And yet they always make a story when they're read back to you. And so now I try to run my characters through that filter before I ever sit down to write a story. And during that process, their names just kind of come to me. And that's not a very satisfactory answer, but that's where they come from. And the plot, because I'm an academic, because I spent a number of decades, you know, doing research in medieval texts and writing books with a whole bunch of footnotes that probably no one listening would ever care to open, and that's fine. I am very accustomed to thinking things out before I write them down. So I have an elaborate system of note cards and color coding and whiteboards, which may end up getting trashed. I may get to the end of a draft and be like, this freaking sucks. It's out of here. Goodbye. And then I go back to the note cards and I make more note cards. Right now, the novel I'm working on I'm looking at it across my desk and it's in 5 color coded piles of note cards.
So you are working on another book.
Yep. fourth draft, and it may go through many more. It's not, although I've had a couple of friends early, because the novel Birds of Wonder was just released on Tuesday. But I have been working with the publicist, and we've been, you know, sending advance review copies out. And so I have gotten some reaction a lot of times from friends who I've given it to. And several people have said they want to see Jess come back. They want to see the detective come back. But the one I'm working on right now is quite different. Its protagonist is a ghost, although she doesn't know that. You figure that out before she does. It's set in a hotel in London that I have cause to know very well, and I'm having a lot of fun with it. I'm hoping to have a draft worthy to deliver to my agent. And I would love that to happen sometime in the fall.
Now, does your academic background lead you to doing a lot of research to incorporate real facts in your manuscripts?
Yes. That's one thing that my academic career has really, really prepared me to do, is to understand how long it takes to do the research. A lot of the work that I do for my academic life involves sitting in archives. It's basically like you're sort of, you know, flipping through an estate sale, looking for stuff, and a good 75% of your time is probably going to be quote unquote wasted, although I don't think it's ever wasted. I think you're learning from everything you look at. But to get the thing that you need to make the argument you need to make, you may spend 3 or 4 days without quote unquote finding anything. And so that long view toward research, I think, has served me well and make me understand if I'm going to, for instance, Liam, the guy who owns the field in which Amber's body is found, Liam is a vintner. And there's a lot of vineyards up here in upstate New York, but just because they're here and I'm here doesn't mean I know enough to write about them. So I spent a lot of time talking to this friend of a friend who owns a vineyard. I spent a lot of time just reading on all sorts of things, from the kinds of pests and diseases that affect the particular sorts of vines that are in this part of the country, where the vines came from, how they were grafted on, you know, the French sources, and how they were grafted onto local grapevines. I know way more than, and certainly, and the temptation then becomes to put everything you learn into the novel. And you can't do that, because you're not writing the history of vineyards in upstate New York. You're writing about a guy who has a vineyard. So you have to balance all the stuff you found out with the two or three little things that you need to make Liam come alive as a vintner. Some of the less savory research I had to do for this, the novel has a component of porn addiction, and it touches on sexual tourism in Thailand, things that are less fun to think about and were certainly a lot less fun to research, but I knew I had to do it. And those two things actually come from unfortunate chapters in my own life, people that I've encountered in my own life that I wish I hadn't. And those things I needed to do something with those. And what I'm doing is putting them in a novel. And if those chapters raise awareness of the fact that way more men than one would ever imagine from the United States and from Europe go to places like Thailand and Brazil on sexual tourism voyages, you know, tours, then I feel like I've maybe done something. I feel like I've maybe done something worthwhile also with that novel. And it was a lot of research into places on the internet that I really did not particularly want to go.
So everybody has they say editing is slaying your darlings. Everybody always has that one chapter that they want to keep in, but they have to take it out to make the scene that they have to take out to make the manuscript work. What chapter did you have to pull?
I had to kill a character, an entire character. I had to take him out. I had to go through the whole novel and take him out. It was heart-wrenching. I had actually one of the voices, Liam's voice, was the final one, the guy who owns the vineyard, who was the one-night stand of the detective. He was in there as a character, but he didn't have a voice. And I had a male character in there by the name of Antonio, who was an exchange student from Mexico who was coming to learn about wine. And one of the reasons I had him in there was because I speak Spanish. I'm bilingual in Spanish. And I guess I wanted to show off how much I know. And it just, it wasn't working. And it took a long, long time. I'm telescoping a long time. This novel, it was funny because I found my agent, actually met my agent at the Squaw Valley Fiction Writers Conference that I mentioned earlier. So for me, the first steps of the process were a total cakewalk. They say, oh, it's so hard to get your short fiction published in journals. Well, no, in a matter of 4 years, I mean, I have plenty of rejection slips like everybody. I could paper a wall, but I have, you know, something like a dozen short stories published in journals. So that was easy, right? And then this wonderful top flight agent pretty much just falls into my lap. From meeting, you know, the kinds of folks that I got to meet at Squaw Valley. So I'm thinking, okay, you know, this is kind of a walk in the park. And it was when we started taking the manuscript out, shopping the manuscript out to editors, that it became clear with the first round that hurts when it comes back, the no's come back and the I'm not loving this come back, that hurts. And I finally had to sit down and really, with an editor friend of mine, really have a heart to heart with the manuscript. And okay, all these six editors have said slightly different things, but they're all pointing at a problem. And what might that problem be? And we identified the fact that Antonio could really be taken out and the story would not only not suffer from it, the story would be clearer. So I had to go through the whole freaking thing, take out everything to do with Antonio, and then I had to start from scratch and write Liam into it. That took about a year.
So writing is not a quick process. And what did you learn about yourself along the journey of writing this manuscript?
Oh, so much. How long have you got? The same writer friend who was someone who kind of, when I mentioned earlier that the stars kind of lined up at a certain point to suggest it was time for me to try this again, this person was dropped in my lap by a mutual friend who has nothing to do with writing. They just used to be neighbors. This is the kind of sort of networks that develop in a small place like Ithaca. And one of the first things she told me, and that I resisted, and I've now come around to the point where I say it too, is that writing is an inherently wasteful process. You have to get used to that. All of that character work that I talked about at the beginning, at that earlier point in our conversation, before I actually sit down to do the actual writing of the novel, most of that doesn't find its way in. And you just have to find a way to make yourself okay with that. And I'm getting there. I'm not there completely. I'm getting there. Another thing that I had to kind of relearn was humility. In my other job, my day job, folks can Google me if they want to through Cornell's website. Admittedly, it's a small pile, right, of scholars who are specialized in medieval Spain. It's not like there's a gazillion of us, but I'm kind of on the top of that pile. I have a named chair at Cornell. I'm the chair of the department. You know, I've attained a certain gravitas and status in my career, which starting over at the bottom, you are nobody as far as the fiction world is concerned. That's very nice that you're the Mary Donlan Alger Professor of Medieval Islamic Art at Cornell University. I don't give a crap. Let me see what you wrote. And you have to get small. You have to make yourself very small. And I started out sending my stories to really not less good because of it, but very small, rather low profile journals rather than pointing straight at the stars, because they're not going to publish somebody they don't know. And so I really had to take myself back to zero. And in a way, it's rejuvenating, because the high that you get from having a story accepted, maybe it's not the absolute top flight journal, but I'm used, frankly, if I send out an article on my scholarly topics, even if it's not very good, although I would never do that, a lot of places would probably accept it because of who I am, because that's just the way the world rolls. And the pleasure that you get from an acceptance, knowing that that's a possibility, that they just saw your name on the manuscript and said, oh, well, we're going to put her in here because, you know, she's well known. So you don't get that big a charge from an acceptance of that article, but from the acceptance of a story, which is also so much more personal, so much more you on the page, so much more vulnerable. You're putting yourself out there and having that accepted. That gives me joy that I can't even really express. It's such a different, kind of a high.
Sounds fascinating. Now, it sounds like you know a lot about Jess that your readers will never know. What is one thing you could tell me about Jess that would make your readers laugh?
Let me think, that would make my readers laugh. Jess eats junk food. She thrives on like drive-through McDonald's, and she smokes behind her mother's back. She's kind of like always a rebellious teenager. She carries, you'll find out this about her, but she carries a spare pair of uniform pants. She's a police detective. She never knows when she's going to hook up with a guy. She's always trying to hook up with a guy. So in her car are always a spare pair of uniform pants, that she can put on when she's not slept at home and go into the police station looking relatively presentable.
So were you channeling your own teenage years and your own younger years when you were writing Jess, or were you more of the well-behaved child just living vicariously?
I was a well-behaved child until I left home. I lived, I'm from Tennessee. I was born in Nashville. I'm adopted, so I know very little about my biological parents. I was brought up in Jackson, Tennessee. I had two preacher granddaddies. We were in church every time the doors were open. Sometimes we went and opened the doors when they weren't open. So I had a very, very conservative, very, very strapped in sort of an upbringing. And when I got to college, my father was sort of like, so you're going to go to college close to home? I was like, nope. So I went to college far away, and I became wild, wild, wild child. And so, yes, a lot of what Jess gets up to and the things that happen to Jess, some of the less fortunate things that happen to Jess are taken directly from my own past. Yeah.
Most writers and radio show hosts know that to connect with your fans, you need to do more than just write books or record the latest podcasts. There are many different elements that go into forming an online platform, but there are also many hidden traps. To make matters worse, solid advice on how to survive the muddy waters is scarce. In the book Hidden Traps, I talk about some of the important issues of working with an online platform, highlighting traps that could put your physical or internet security at risk or be harmful to your reputation. Are your social media posts just links with a few disjointed words making you look like someone who can't complete a sentence? Did your new website cost you more than you anticipated? Are you leaking your personal contact details across the web without even knowing it? Then you need Hidden Traps. Hidden Traps is now available in paperback and ebook from a variety of retailers, including Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and Kobo. Visit blackwolfpublications.com for more details.
If you're 85 or younger, would you like peace of mind and comfort for your family? We're Final Expense Direct with an urgent message for you. The average funeral today costs over $8,000, but the most you'll get from government benefits is $255. How will your family pay the difference? We can help. Our senior plans start as low as just a dollar a day and pay up to $30,000 for a funeral and other final expenses. Peace of mind is easy. There's no medical exam. You'll have lifetime coverage, and your plan can't be canceled as long as you pay your premiums. Call now for free information about our senior plans. Answer a few simple questions and receive approval right on the phone. Plus, call right now and we'll give you a discount prescription card for free. Call 800-553-8687. That's 800-553-8687. Again, 800-553-8687.
KLRN Radio has advertising rates available. We have rates to fit almost any budget. Contact us at advertising@klrnradio.com.
Everyone loves liberty. Our rights come from God, not the government. So why are you letting other people tell you what's best for your healthcare? Exercise your freedom with Liberty HealthShare. Liberty HealthShare is a community of people who voluntarily share one another's medical costs. Liberty HealthShare is founded on the idea that most people truly want to help one another. Healthcare sharing allows members to do just that as a true community that supports one another in times of need. Liberty believes people should make decisions for themselves and their families. Members are able to take back the freedom to make their own decisions about their health care. Freedom from guilt or doubt about how your money is used. You have the freedom to direct your health care, not to be dictated to by bureaucrats. Stop letting others tell you what to do and join a community of like-minded people. Exercise your freedom. Join Liberty HealthShare and take back the control of your health care while helping those around you. Call Liberty at 855-58-LIBERTY. Again, that's 855-58-LIBERTY for more information, or you can check them out at libertyhealthshare.org. Again, that's libertyhealthshare.org.
Sometimes riders feel lost, unsure why a passage may not be working. It takes another set of eyes to help us nurture our riding into full maturity. At Black Wolf Editorial Services, we strive to enable riders to develop and grow, offering manuscript critiques and line edits through a mentoring editorial style. We also offer assistance on generating a rider's bio for your websites. Black Wolf Editorial Services, nurturing your riding into maturity. For a full list of services, visit blackwolfeditorial.com.
Did you have fun putting these stories from your own past on the page, or was it in some ways painful?
Some of the stuff is really fun. I don't want to give away. Readers who read the book will, when they get to this point of the novel, they'll go, oh, that's what she was talking about. The worst thing that happens to Jess is pretty much an accurate rendition of one of the worst things that ever happened to me. It has to do with sexual assault. And that's what I meant earlier about protecting your characters and not letting bad things happen to them. And in my own case, really risky behavior, you know, the rape victim is never to blame for what happens to her or him ever, ever. But it's also true that if she or he hadn't put her or himself in certain situations, it likely wouldn't have happened. And that is the case. That's the case in my case, and it's the case in Jess's case. And it also has to do it, both of those, you know, how those situations came about in slightly different ways, but very parallel ways, have to do with troubled relationships with a father. And so that's what I meant by protecting her. And when I finally, it was actually at Squaw in this workshop where we're meant to sort of find our characters' joyful moments, terrified moments, and shameful moments. I found myself telling those things about myself that I never really told anybody, to this room of 12 people that I didn't know, who were transcribing my statements and going to read them back to me. And it was still, even at that point, that morning left me completely drained. I felt like someone had just vacuumed my soul out from some orifice and left me, you know, and it took me 4 more years to realize that what I had done was lay the groundwork for the rock bottom of Jess's character. It took me a long, long time to realize that. And I actually came to it kind of through the back door of excerpting parts of the novel and writing short stories. And that's when I put them in. And then I said, oh, wow, this is what this was about the whole time.
So given the fact that you had a conservative upbringing and you were very much a wild child in college, and then you write this character by the name of Jesse, who's very much seeming like a wild young adult, was it hard to distance yourself from that character so that you could bring her voice, not yours, to the page?
Very, very hard. Earlier when you asked me who the hardest character was for me to write, it was her. And I had to go through a number of not just one iteration of the process of writing out Jess's character without not telling the story, but writing who she is. I had to do that probably 4 or 5 times in order to achieve the distance that I needed to. I finally think I nailed it. And the proof of that is that we found a publisher for it. After I made those changes, near misses, heartbreaking near misses with, you know, big time publishers, and it would come back. It's just like, you know, I like this and this and this about it, but it's just not for me. And it was really once I excavated Jess to the rock bottom and went through another three or four rounds of character writing, kind of pulling her away from me, that we finally came up with a product that that did find a publisher. So it was very hard.
I will say that I'm a person that will pick up a book because of the characters. Mm. In fact, I often like to go on another adventure with a favorite character again. So Are you going to bring Jess back in another book?
I hadn't thought that I would, but I've heard several times people say they want more of her. So it's very possible that I might. Not the one that I'm finishing now, because that one's really far advanced and it's a completely different thing. But I might very well return to her. I know that that is a very good way to gain a readership. I wouldn't do that for just a marketing reason. But for instance, Louise Erdrich, I don't know if you know she's a Native American writer. She writes mostly about Native American subjects. And I have read now several of her novels, and she does revisit the same characters. And I like that. I feel like and sometimes you'll just get a glimpse of them, right? And then you'll know that they're coming back in a different novel or a different chapter. So I think it's something I might want to play with, because I do like Jess, and I actually miss her, which sounds a sort of strange thing to say, but I miss her.
Well, on that note, it is time to pay the radio station bills. So I am going to pour Cynthia a fresh cup of coffee, and we will see you on the other side. And thank y'all for hanging in there with us while we paid those radio station bills. And I am going to pour myself a fresh cup of coffee. And of course, author Cynthia Robinson, oh boy, I got to untie my tongue today, is still with us. And thank you for hanging in there, Cynthia. Now, we have talked all about this character, Jess, and her adventures. What's your second favorite character?
Oh, wow. I think it would have to be her mother. I was about to say Waldo, the plant whisperer, but I think it's Jess's mother. It's Beatrice. The relationship between the mother and the daughter is a focus of a lot of kind of attention throughout the novel. Beatrice she's an English teacher. She is a specialist in literature of the time of Shakespeare and slightly after, the Jacobeans. She's extremely well read, but she's really flighty. And she's also a big proponent, a big champion of theater for high school kids. And she produces these plays with her students every year. And she's also someone who refuses to see the bad side of anything, which means that she refuses to see a lot of the reality around her. And she refuses to see a particular reality having to do with her late husband, who was an ornithologist, which is where the title comes from, Birds of Wonder. There's a bird theme that kind of weaves itself through the novel as well. And Birds of Wonder comes from a Shakespearean quote that is very dear to Beatrice. And she and Jess clash for all sorts of reasons. One, you know, being that Beatrice refuses to see things that she doesn't like that are unsavory. And Jess is someone who always wants to uncover the truth. I mean, she's a detective, right? That's how she spends her time, that she does it for a reason. And so she and Beatrice are always clashing. Beatrice would like Jess to be a normal young woman. Beatrice would probably like Jess to get married and settle down. And those are things that Jess is just not going to do. Beatrice would like Jess to wear something other than jeans. Beatrice would like Jess to wear makeup. Jess is not going to do any of that. Beatrice would like it if Jess would stop going around town and, you know, hooking up with married men and the town being small enough that everyone finds out and Jess doesn't care. Beatrice would like it if she would stop that. So I would say Beatrice is my second favorite character because she reflects things that I've seen in people that I've known throughout my life who just don't want to see what's in front of them. And it's in a way, it's kind of a protective mechanism for themselves. And I always find that interesting to observe.
All right. So the question I ask all my guests, what is your favorite coffee shop treat?
I love biscotti, and the place where I go makes their own. And it's easy to maybe convince yourself that biscotti are a little bit less sinful than some of the other, which is of course not true, but some of the other sort of more gooey treats behind the glass. So I love chocolate biscotti dipped in chocolate, which is actually probably as sinful as pretty much anything else behind the counter.
Gotta have that chocolate. Now, back to the book. How did you come up with the title?
This book was shopped out to editors under a different title. It was shopped out to editors under the title The Science of Birds, which is also relevant to the book because, as I mentioned earlier, the deceased father character was an ornithologist. Actually, Cornell is home to one of the premier ornithology schools and laboratories in the world. And since coming here, I've always liked birds, but since coming here and sort of living more out in the country than I used to, I'm an avid watcher of my bird feeder. I wouldn't go so far as to call myself a birder. I don't think I really deserve that much credit for what I do, but I'm very interested in birds. And Waldo, the maybe schizophrenic plant whisperer character, also has a very peculiar, close relationship with birds. And so I was associating birds with knowledge. And at one point, the editor that ended up publishing the book, Bob Colley at Standing Stone, said, I just don't think the title's not working for me. You need to do something else. And we threw spaghetti at the wall for weeks, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And it was during the rewriting of one of the final Beatrice scenes. Beatrice is someone who may not remember what she had for breakfast yesterday, but she can spout Shakespeare at the drop of a dime. And the bird of wonder is from Shakespeare's Henry VIII, the fifth scene of the fifth act, and the reference is Queen Elizabeth, and the reference of the bird of wonder is actually the phoenix that rises from the ashes when something looks as though it has been lost and yet it still lives. And I thought that was a very fitting a reference to a lot of what goes on in this novel is characters hitting rock bottom and most of them coming back from that in ways that the reader may not necessarily be expecting. And so I thought that it was very fitting. It's, Beatrice spouts Shakespeare, and the novel is in a lot of ways about finding a way to go on after something terrible has happened.
Well, that's a very fitting novel given all the chaos that's recently befallen our nation. Did you feel any pressure to write a female protagonist, or are you open to male protagonists? How do you feel that the culture has influenced that?
I think I naturally gravitate toward female protagonists. I think it's almost something I do without even considering. Although, having said that, four of the voices in Birds of Wonder, four of the six voices are men. So I always think I can't write men. And then there's proof to the contrary in the fact that I created these four other characters. This novel has been, I first conceived it, like in 2011. So it's been a long time in the gestation process, let's say. So I can't necessarily say that it's a response to the Me Too movement, but I think it is extremely relevant to the Me Too movement. And because it collects these various themes surrounding, there's sexual assault. As I said, there's sexual tourism. There's kind of the moral question. Where do we sit along the moral question of porn and how it, I would argue, disproportionately adversely affects women. So all of these questions were already in there and sort of stewing in the soup ever since I conceived the novel. But with the really with the coming onto the screen or coming to our consciousness of the Me Too movement in the late summer, I became aware of just how relevant this novel was to those themes. So that the fact that it's relevant isn't, but it's entirely relevant.
Do you, in your work, you do a lot of research, and you, like you said, you sometimes will go for days without quote unquote finding anything. What was the one fact you wanted to have in that manuscript that was the hardest for you to find?
This is going to sound really, really nerdy, but it comes, it's related to the vineyard aspect of Liam's existence. Some crazy stuff happens in his vineyard with birds, a lot of which is related to the screwing around with the growing season of global warming. And I didn't necessarily want, I was not necessarily dependent on the fact that this is a true thing that could happen to put it in there, but I wanted to know that it was possible. And so I spent literally days reading history of climate change affecting growing seasons, affecting the grapes' process of sugaring, affecting what happens when a flock of birds, like, is it possible for what happens in the next to last Liam scene? Is that a thing that could happen? And after about, I would say a good, you know, I wasn't doing it full time, but a good month of following up leads and reading. Cornell also has a really, a very, very prestigious, school of grape cultivation. And they have, you can imagine the nerdy kind of stuff they have on their website. So here I was reading this stuff. I'm not a math and science person. Unfortunately, I'm a female cliche in that respect. I'm the history and lit, you know, classes always made me the happiest. So here I was with all of these charts and graphs, which are things that I totally hate. And I finally came to the conclusion that yes, what I make happen with the bird infestation and the dry rot is something that could happen in upstate New York. And I was incredibly proud of myself. That occupies maybe two pages. So that's what I meant earlier about the kind of, you know, this is a slow process. It's an inherently wasteful process. A lot of what you're doing is never going to wind up on the page. But I particularly because I'm not a science and math kind of girl, and I made myself do that research. And so I felt very proud of myself for that.
You mentioned it also starts out like a police procedural. Did you research police procedures and talk to law enforcement and things like that to try and get the facts right in your manuscript?
I didn't talk to law enforcement, but I spent a whole lot of time on police academy websites, the kinds of crime logs that you can come across in, you know, if you do your research, the sorts of procedure that is proper when a crime is being investigated, the sorts of searches that are legal and illegal. And I made Jess is not a great cop. I will just alert readers to that. It's been funny. A lot of the reactions that I've had from crime novel nerds, because those are out there, and I knew what I was doing. I was going to bend the genre a little bit. This is not a full-on crime novel, and I knew when I did that I was risking having them like jump all over me. And some of them have like a real, you know, this is not correct police procedure. When Jess does something that is not correct police procedure, I know that, and I'm making her do it for a reason, which you eventually discover why she has such a personally invested attitude to what she's doing, that she's so focused and so intent on making someone pay for this that she'll bend the rules in ways that are reckless and that eventually get her in trouble. And so when she does something, all y'all crime novel nerds out there, when she does something that you know is incorrect police procedure, I know that too. And she's doing it for a reason. Don't get mad at me.
Well, I've heard it said you can get away with a lot in a manuscript as long as you hang a lantern on it and make it obvious to the reader that you know this is a little out of the ordinary. Anyway, what advice would you give to women?
Just in general?
Women who are reading your book and they're not sure what they want to do with their lives and they're just like, They don't know if they should be that scrappy person or and fight for what they want or just go along with the crowd.
Always be the scrappy person. And being the scrappy person is a different thing for different people, right? You're not necessarily going to be flamboyantly scrappy, but know that you have a right to do, to live how you want to live. And if someone, assuming it doesn't involve criminal activity, in which case you're on your own, but if there's something in your life, some person, some situation in your life that is keeping you from doing what you believe you should be doing, then really take a look at it and think about how you can get that thing out of your way. Be that in the flamboyant manner that Jess does, in kind of in your face way that Jess does, or be it in a very sort of under the table, I'm going to outsmart you kind of way. But women now more than ever in the climate in which we live, I think we're seeing, it's ugly to see, but I think we're seeing that even though we know we've made tons of strides forward since the days we couldn't vote, since the days it was expected that we were all at home barefoot and pregnant, obviously huge amounts of progress have been made. But I think the last, shall we say, couple of years have really shown the light on the fact that a lot of the attitudes that permitted those unfortunate circumstances to exist are still fully in place. And we still have to go up against those. And if one of those attitudes is affecting you personally, you should not have to live that way. And you have a right to try to change it.
I think that is great advice. And I hope a lot of your readers find some inspiration in this book. Now, what was the hardest scene? A lot of writers get emotionally invested in their scenes. Was there a scene in your manuscript that just brought you?
Yeah. It is kind of, I would say this scene is the heart of the novel in a way. Beatrice, the mother, is constantly, she doesn't understand why Jess avoids her so much. And the reader, and I've had several readers say to me, gee, at first I was kind of annoyed by the fact that Jess is always so short with her mother and couldn't figure out why that was. And Jess is short with Beatrice. And eventually you find out why and you kind of go, oh. And this is the scene in which you find out why. And Beatrice is always making these little excuses to try to get Jess to come over. She's always trying to invent a reason to ask Jess to have dinner or to ask Jess to do something for her. She's trying to establish a closeness, an intimacy with a daughter who doesn't want to have that with her. And that's kind of painful to watch. And so one of the, you know, when the culmination of this process is when the case has kind of blown up in Jess's face, as readers will see why that is and how that happens. And the day before, she had given a kind of maybe answer to Beatrice about having dinner, which Beatrice took as a yes. And Beatrice, I have to plug this computer in. I'm going to take it over here. Beatrice holds her feet to the fire on it and kind of makes her come over. And they end up having this conflagration of a confrontation around the issue that has been keeping them, that has been keeping Jess away from her mother. It has to do with the deceased father. It has to do with certain things that he did when on his bird researches in far-flung places, things that Beatrice has not wanted to confront and that Jess tries to force her hand and make her confront. And then when she leaves she leaves on a not good note, a number of memories associated with that event just basically assault her as she's driving away. And it's a very emotional. I've had readers tell me it's a brutal scene. One worth reading, but one that really kind of takes it out of you emotionally. And that was really the heart of the novel. And that was the final sort of piece that I put in the puzzle. And it was a hard one to put in there.
Other than the dead body at the beginning of your novel, do you kill off any of your characters, or do you have plans of killing off any of your characters? And do we see
no one else dies in this novel? Couple people get comeuppances that are appropriate to them, as readers will see. And if I if, and I don't want to give away why, but if I were to pick up Jess in another novel, it would probably need to be some new characters would need to be introduced. And I'll let people read it. And once you've read the novel, you'll understand why that is.
New characters are fun. What can I say? So what advice would you give to the writers that are listening about pursuing their writing and trying to make their own name in this industry?
It is hard. You have to really, 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 really want it. And you have to be willing to put more skin in the game than you could ever possibly imagine. The thing that you and I've returned to several times throughout this conversation, writing is an inherently wasteful process. Get used to the fact that not everything you put on the page you can use. Get used to the fact that the research is going to take you probably three times as long as you thought it would. Read widely, read things that are out of your comfort zone so that you learn, writers that you would like to emulate. If you're a Kindle user, have those books in paper form as well, because it makes it that much easier for you to return to passages that you particularly like. It's that much easier for you to research into the methods. Like if there's a writer that you particularly admire, how did she or he do that thing that you so admire? Deconstruct the novel, you know, to give yourself a little bit of a lit class at home. Go to a workshop. I mentioned earlier this, the one at Squaw Valley Fiction Writers, Squaw Valley Writers Community. And if you look them up on the web, you'll see they have a poetry workshop, they have a fiction workshop, and they also have a nonfiction essayist workshop. They have screenwriting. It's hard to get into. You might apply a couple times and not get in, but if you can possibly go there, I would highly, highly recommend it. And there are other good workshops around the country, because you get to see your work in other people's hands. You get to hear other people critique your work. And sometimes that's hard. Sometimes it's hard to hear, but you always learn from it. Have a writing buddy. A dear friend that I met, the first year I went to school, I went twice. And the first year, a woman who was in my writing workshop, we were workshopped the last day after the Saturday night when everyone had been, you know, at the parties until 4 a.m. So it was not the most advantageous slot. And she and I are now really good friends. We always, we swap manuscripts. She's read more versions of Birds than I care to count. So having a writing group or a buddy who's always a trusted reader, a couple of those who'll tell you when something sucks. And you can also tell them when something of theirs sucks and everyone's still friends and you know you have to go back to the drawing board. Don't give up. But also realize that it is, as I said, I think at the beginning of the first half, or maybe when you and I were chatting beforehand, writing is a tough mistress. It will make you pay. She will hurt you and you have to keep coming back and letting her hurt you again. And eventually, maybe she'll make the path a little bit easier for you, but she's going to be hard on you at first.
Well, that sounds like outstanding advice. And I have one final question for you.
Yes.
What is your social media contact information for people who would like to get in touch with you?
I would love to hear from anybody about the book about writing or anything. My website, Cynthia Robinson Books, all one word, .com. And there you have links. There's a contact link through which folks can write to me. I'm also on Instagram, and they can connect to that actually by going to my website, scrolling down to the bottom of the homepage, and there's actually my Instagram feed is there. Or you can search for me on Instagram, Cynthia Robinson 2605. And I'm actually not on Twitter. I know you're waiting for me to say Twitter. I'm not on Twitter. I'm not on Facebook. Shock. I find that those things are just they're too much of a time suck. I actually had zero online presence. If you can believe, I don't own a cell phone. Shock. But my publicist, with whom you've been chatting in order to make this nice interview happen, she forced me. She's like, "You got to do something. Pick one." And so we chose Instagram because I'm an art historian, because I'm visually oriented, and I love being on Instagram. I have a good time on Instagram, but I don't do Facebook and I don't do Twitter, because otherwise, when would I write?
Valid comments. Many people do get sucked into the world of social media. Well, for anyone looking to catch up with me, you can find me on Twitter at Radio Host Jesse. And of course, you can always check out jessiescoffeeshop.com. Now, I have come to my favorite part of the show. I am going to pour myself a cup of coffee and grab this copy of Birds of Wonder off the table. And I'm going to settle down with a great book. And I will see you next time in the coffee shop.